Welcome to Packet Pushers Heavy Networking, and in today's sponsored podcast with Interoptic, they return to the show, and thanks to Interoptic for sponsoring us, because without them, we just wouldn't be here. Now, we talk a lot about the Ethernet transition from lower to higher speeds, from 1 gig to 10 gig to 25 gig, 40 gig, 100 gig, 400 gig, but what we aren't delving into is the fact that these higher speeds create challenges for cabling and for the design of data centers and for the campuses environments that you all live in. And by challenges, I mean there's a whole bunch of things that change with the transition to higher speed internet, because the higher data rates of the signal means that your old cabling is actually probably not good enough. You'll get all sorts of strange issues where the signaling or the propagation of the waveforms down the cable actually changes, and your old Cat5 cable isn't going to make the grade. So when you're considering the next 10 years in your data center or in your campus or wherever it is that you're going to lay out some high-speed internet on your premises, what are you thinking about when you're doing your 25, 40 gig, 50 gig, 100 gig networking designs? And I don't think that people often consider cabling as a key factor in working out the price of your pluggable modules. Now, Interoptic, of course, as a sponsor, you probably know them, sell pluggable modules, SFPs, optical modules, all types of cabling associated with that, so that you actually get to cut costs and you get a better result at the end. But what a lot of people don't realize is that it's a fair chance that newer Ethernet speeds are not compatible with your existing cable, and you need to start factoring the cable costs in of actually upgrading to the next generation. So when you get those new pluggable modules, you're going to have to start thinking about your cabling as well. That's the premise of today's show, which is how to retain your legacy data center infrastructure when upgrading to 100 gig or 50 gig or 40 gig or 25 gig. Now, joining us today is Alec Lutzko. He's a lead network architect from Server Central. And also joining us is Robert Conan from Interoptic to get deep into these topics. So I want to kick straight off with the cabling considerations of, if you've got a data center of 50 micron and 62.5 micron of fiber optic cable, Rob, can I use both types of cable going forward, or am I at the point where 62.5 micron is dead?
Well, the 62.5 micron fiber, as you know, had all kinds of production problems back in the day when they used to make it. And the core in the dead center of those fibers had all sorts of issues in terms of the index of refraction of the actual glass that was in there. So they worked pretty good at 100 megabits, and you could even go to 1 gig on them. But when you tried to go to 10 gig, if you use the standard VCSEL type of lasers, they didn't work anymore. So you had to use a very special kind of module to go to 10 gig called the LRM module, which used a special kind of laser and was much more tolerant of the older fibers. There was even these mode conditioning patch cords. I don't know if you remember those. And how those worked is that they kind of deflected the light around the dead center of the core to kind of try and avoid that blank spot, so you could get a little more distance out of your fiber.
Oh, so what you're saying is the actual optical core of the cable, when it was manufactured, the actual very center of that glass fiber, the 62.5 micron glass fiber bit, was actually like optically dead.
It was, yeah. It badly distorted the signal, which you didn't notice at 100 meg because the eyes are very long and big. But at 10 gig, it starts to become something of a problem. So that's why they came out with the LRM module, to allow customers who had an older 62.5 micron plant to upgrade to 10 gig. But beyond 10 gig, that older fiber is pretty much dead. You got to hope that you have a 50 micron installed.
Basically, you want it to be blue and not orange.
Exactly.
So if you've got old fiber that's been sitting around in your campus, which is where I think this would largely happen, and you're looking at orange 62.5 micron, you're probably going to have to think about throwing it out or finding these LRM modules to run it at 10 gig. Does the LRM module run at the same distances as 1 gig?
It does not. It's limited to about 300 meters, which is pretty long. I mean, unless you're trying to go up and down risers, or you have a particular, or you're between buildings or something like that, 300 meters will definitely, unless you're like the likes of Google or Facebook, it will probably get you from one end of your data center to the other.
I'll say that if you want to get from one end of something like, say, 350 East Cermak to the other end, no, I know for a fact that you're more than 500 meters there, just snaking around the floor on one level, not counting risers.
Yeah, you're talking about a good-sized colo. You can easily get past 300 meters.
Easily. And you're now looking at the point where The orange cable should be in the trash anyway. Why did you put the blue stuff in instead of putting the yellow stuff when you did your infrastructure? And to be honest, I can't remember the last time I saw a new install, so we're talking at least 18 years now, that didn't have yellow fiber as part of a pull between buildings.
What, so you're saying yellow fiber is single mode?
Yes.
All right, so you're going to call everything a color today, and it's going to throw me off because I'm used to talking about SMF.
Okay, SMF 28.
Right. Yeah, so single mode is yellow, 50 micron multi-mode is blue, and 62.5 micron is orange. So if you're using orange 62.5 micron multi-mode fiber, you might be able to make it work if you get these special pluggable modules that get you the thing, but everything else, you're really looking at 50 micron multi-mode or single mode.
The thing that a lot of people looked at was, what's my dollars per meter? And once you start looking at it for, say, 48 or 96 strands, your costs are actually in labor, not material.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. The multi-mode and the single mode, it's a little bit more expensive to terminate single mode, but not that much. I mean, really.
Buy preterm tails and fusion splice them.
Yeah, fusion mm-hmm. splice them at the top of rack. Exactly. You buy the tail circuits, and then at the top of rack, you run your cables and then run them into a fusion splice box there if you're going to have backhauls. I guess that gets into a question. I've seen a lot of people eschewing having backbone cables at all, like the idea of running cable between racks and then fusion splicing in the top of the rack. What about using active optical cables instead? I've seen 40-meter active optical cables quite often used in row to replace the need to run cabling at all.
I have a problem with AOC.
tell us about it, because I've used it in some places and it's been fine. But if you've got a problem, I want to hear that story.
My problem with AOC is basically economic. Hmm. AOC cables cost more if you're just going to use it as an intra-rack or inter-rack patch. Hmm. AOCs are going to cost you probably 20% more than a couple of SR optics and a piece of fiber.
So, and they're definitely going to cost you more in the long run, because you have to throw that whole thing away when you go to the next speed upgrade, as opposed to just simple fiber.
See, now that's a feature, because I want that, right? For some people, there's value in as you decommission a rack, you pull out all the fiber with it, so the rack is then empty, so that when you reprovision it, it's actually clean.
Yes. My point is, if you have an AOC cable that breaks, you throw out a $700 cable. If you have $250 optics and a $50 patch, and the patch breaks, replace the patch.
Right, okay.
We routinely go through racks and take all the cable, bin it, and start fresh.
And now, you work at Server Central, which is a large hosting environment. You've got hundreds or thousands of servers in that environment?
Tens, yeah.
Tens, like tens of thousands, not tens.
Tens of thousands.
Sorry, just to put that in perspective. So why would you just throw, I think that would be a new idea to a lot of people. Why would you just throw the cable away? Is it just because it wears out over time? Does the gravity cause it to fail?
It gets bent, it gets stomped, it gets flexed when it gets installed, and it costs us real money to recertify.
So what you're saying is, when you decommission a rack, you would then go in and send in a cabling team to recertify the testing of the cable to validate that it's viable.
Well, if we have a rack that has a lot of top of rack patching, and all of our cabinet to core is structured cabling, mm-hmm. so that's going to stay there. But inside a rack, if we've got 100, 200 fiber patch cables or DAC cables, we pull them out, we're probably going to trash them, because it'll cost us more money and manpower to recertify them for reuse.
I see. You're talking about in rack, not between the rack, right?
Yeah. No. Okay. Between racks, we use structured cabling, so it's going to come in, terminate. Everything is in a cable management system.
But in rack, you wouldn't use active coax or active optical in the rack, because you don't need the distance. You've just got to get from the top, from the mid rack to the servers. You'd put the switches in the middle of the rack, I assume.
Well, mid-rack to servers, DAC, for 10 gig, DAC cables are wonderful, unless you start bundling them and get crosstalk issues. I'm a great believer in fiber inside of cabinets, okay?
So that's an interesting one. I haven't heard of crosstalk between coaxial cables. Are you talking hundreds in a bundle or tens in a bundle?
When you get about 50 or 60 in a bundle, you can start having issues with some Trident 2-based switches. The actual vendors are protected, but we've seen it.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to get the general idea. It's the sort of thing, if you're looking at something and you're going like, why am I having problems? This would be an issue. So 50 to 60 cables in a bundle, you start seeing crosstalk between the coaxial cables.
Yeah.
Does it depend on what kind of cables? Like, do you see it with all coaxial cables or just ones that are poorly shielded?
Ones that are poorly shielded, which tend to be the cheap ones that people like because they're cheap.
Because they're cheap, yep.
So this is one of the – so this is an interesting point. So if you buy really cheap passive coax or active coax cables, this is how they can cut corners and make them cheaper. I've always visualized the optical market, the OSFP, the small form factor pluggable market, is three levels. There's vendor expensive because they're charging you a license fee to use their optics. There's a mid-range, which is quality and support of the opticals. And then right down the bottom, they've just cut every corner possible. So what you're suggesting is that if you go for the cheapest possible optic, you might end up with they've cut shielding or cut the quality of the copper or something like that.
Yeah. And when you say optic, I would say pluggable there because honestly, cheap optics that work out of the box will probably just keep working.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I mean, you know, these optics nowadays, of course, they're commoditized in terms of their functionality, but not their quality and reliability. I mean, that's, you know, to take another example, that's the difference between a $120 set of tires and $300 set of tires. You know, what you're paying for is assurance of reliability. All the lasers in SFP optics are prone to early mortality. That's just a thing that happens with both VCSELs and edge emitters. As high as 30% of them can fail in the first 3 months. And the only way that they can screen for this is that they have to do this expensive testing where they put them in an oven, power them up, run them for days or sometimes even a couple of weeks and monitor them very closely to see if they're degrading even a little bit that they can measure. And if they are, they have to get chucked. But if they seem to be stable, then they can be sent out into the field. That's this kind of testing is what differentiates the expensive optics from the cheap ones. The cheap ones, if you just buy a whole bunch of spares, if a few of them die on you, you can swap them out. But it depends on just, you know, what is your tolerance to risk. And
So if you've got a manned data center and you've got redundant type situations in the connectors, you could just get them. And if you feel that you can just wander downstairs and replace it, then get the cheap ones. But if you're in a data center that's, you know, the one that I did work on was a 12-hour plane flight away, you might want to go with the more expensive ones because getting down there to replace them is very, very difficult, even sending in remote arms and legs.
Let me give you an interesting concept of pets versus cattle.
Okay.
The old pets versus cattle. You don't want to be treating your server like pets. You want to be treating them like cattle.
Exactly.
At the end of the day, you've got 500 cattle. You lose a half a dozen, you don't care. You've still got 494 cows.
We've been talking about optical here, but the truth is, in 1 in 10 gig at least, most intra-rack connections these days are Cat6A because the transceivers come built onto the motherboard and copper switches are cheaper than fiber switches and it's just realism. And that's where you really get near-end crosstalk issues.
So this is at 10 gig, you're seeing people
this
still doing.
This is at 10 gig.
Yeah. When you get to 25 gig and up, you're not going to be using TwisterPet.
No, but we're looking at keeping our 10 gig investment, moving to 25, 50, and 100 and 400. What are you going to do? Yeah. For it. I don't know anybody who's making a server with an onboard 25 gig cage yet.
Not yet, no. And I believe it at this point in time, if you're running 25 gig NICs, you probably want an accelerated NIC to handle the throughput because the CPU motherboard really isn't prepped to handle that sort of IO. That's a generalized statement. So when you get to 25 gig, you're probably wanting to choose your NIC, I think, today.
Any Xeon running Linux will push 25 gig out of a commodity Intel chipset NIC.
Well, then speculate that why Intel wouldn't put a 25 gig on the motherboard and then downstep it to 10, like autofail to 10. 10 gig.
Money.
Just money?
Yeah.
Not enough customers want 25 gig, so it's not worth putting on the motherboard?
Not enough customers want it yet.
Right.
I used to work at Intel, and I can tell you that they just kind of fell behind the other companies who, you know, rushed into 25 gig. They got a little bit caught with their pants down and had to rush to kind of catch up. And well, if you're a company of, you don't turn on a dime. Things.
Yeah, slowly. Their definition of rush is a little is modest is a modest pace, shall we say?
But yeah, no, 25 gig is the future and is pretty much happening now and will happen. It works too nicely, you know, you could get the 40 gig breakouts to 10 gig ports on servers. Everybody liked that. And so they just copied that model at 100/25 gig.
I want to loop back around. There was a really important statement that you said there. You said something like 30% of optics fail within 3 months. And you actually were hinting that the lasers, or you actually said the VCSELs and the edge emitters. Now, perhaps better if you explain what a VCSEL and edge emitter is, because that's the laser that's inside the pluggable, isn't it?
Correct, yeah. For multi-mode, cheap multi-mode lasers, those are called VCSELs, vertical cavity surface emitting lasers. Those are low-cost multi-mode fiber pluggable modules, and those VCSELs can fail, especially when you have a bunch of them in one module. If any one of them fails, that's that's considered a failure, and you got to toss the whole thing. As I was saying, and as you were asking, for these vertical lasers that they use, and edge emitting lasers like 1310 and 1550 lasers, which are LR and ER and that sort of thing, they are prone to early failures. And that's just due to very small flaws in the crystalline structure of the laser when it's being made at the factory. And the only way to catch that is these long, expensive tests where you power them up at maximum, heat the thing up to like 85 degrees and watch it really carefully to see if it starts to degrade or if the current through it starts to increase and stuff like that.
So I think the takeaway for our audience might be it's not unreasonable for optics to fail within a few weeks of using them.
Not at all.
That's reasonably common.
But there's a bathtub curve. Mm-hmm. The first 3 months, you've got lots of infant mortality, and then you're going to run steady state for a decade, and then you're going to start having age-related failures.
Okay. So if they survive the first 3 months, you're good for a decade. After that, you might start to think to yourself, it's time to rotate these out, because it's not exactly that they wear out, but they literally wear out, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Age thermal-related failure. There are no moving parts.
Rob, is there a difference between vendors then? So if I'm buying cheap or expensive optics, and this is a question I literally was asked today, do these lasers then, do the more expensive ones have better quality, or is this just across the board? Because you must all be buying the same components. It's not like these components come from hundreds of companies. They come from two or three.
The lasers themselves come from a small number of companies, but there's definitely better quality ones than others, and they get binned at the factory. And the best quality ones go to the sort of tier one manufacturers, and the poorest quality ones go to people who, like, price is their only concern. And like I said, the difference is that even with the high quality ones, you have to test them properly to make sure that they are working and will continue to work for the first 3 months. But if you don't, if you don't care so much, and like, okay, we'll just bear with the fact that we'll have a lot of dropouts in the first few months.
Well, it does come down to the price differential. If you're paying 1/10 or 1/20 at the price of what a full priced optic is, then that failure rate might just be acceptable. Might be acceptable to take on the chest.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. No, that's totally true. But we have customers who, it's like you mentioned, the livestock versus pets thing. For them, really, their servers are pets. In fact, they're like those pets you see in the kennel shows where they're like groomed
and fluffed.
Groomed and fed beer and massaged.
Exactly. Yeah. Because these server, one or two of their servers are running like some sort of highly classified, extremely critical piece of software that can't possibly fail and, can't be, they don't want duplicated over like 100 different servers or something like that. So for them, failure isn't an option.
Right.
And failure in those cases, is always a reality.
Yeah. But in your case, Alex, when you're talking about tens of thousands of servers, you'd be much more in the cattle type idea, and there's a trade-off to be made between high price, medium price, low price, and you have to decide which works for you best.
There is a trade-off, and the hyperscalers are totally cattle. Server Central is a boutique operation in a lot of ways, so we have lots of smaller customers that we aggregate out to, so for some of them, they are pets. They're very definitely pets.
So, Alex, you mentioned before that you're wanting to get to 25 gig, or at least you hinted at it. How are you looking at future-proofing for 25, 50, 100 gig, and what sort of changes are you making to step up into that area?
Functionally, we're looking at 25 gig is going to stay inside a cabinet, so that'll either be active digital cables, DACs, or local fiber SFPs, or, distressingly, those silly 4x1 copper breakout cables that some people sell.
Are you literally saying like a 100 gig with 4x25 gig coaxes?
Yeah.
Oh my God. That's a thing?
Some people love those things. They're very popular. Yeah.
Oh, they're a thing. And
what are they called?
Breakout cables.
Oh, the 100 gig to 25 gig breakouts. Yeah, no, that's, yeah. Okay. Oh, I got you. I thought you were saying people were using them point to point.
No.
No, okay. Yeah.
And the reason I don't like those in the pet scenario is if you lose one leg for any reason, you have to take all four devices offline.
Right, okay.
To replace it. Same with any breakout optic. The future proofing is 100 gig or 400 gig top of rack going out single mode to a core or to a local spine.
Exactly.
So you would say, you would recommend to people to lean away from breakout cables and just buy more ports on the switch. I guess there's a balance here between the price you pay per port on the switch and the price you pay for the breakout cable.
It's a balance, and the prices aren't that different when you finally look at it, because the big cost of, say, a Trident 3-based switch is the Trident 3 chip itself. And then you've got the 48 PHYs that are physically driving things. Mm-hmm. And then after that, the OEO, or it's all pretty much the same.
Although we do have customers specifically in the telecom space. For them, space, you know, density is very, very critical. Sometimes they're having to work within small closets and that sort of thing. So if they can shove, quite frankly, four times as many ports into a box, they'll go for it, because that extra 2U or on a rack is more space for something else. Yeah. So for them, it's not so much about the cost of the box, it's the cost of the place where the box is sitting and how much that space costs.
And the minus 48 volt and the battery backup.
Mm. Yeah.
I spent a bunch of years working for CLEC.
Okay. You know the drill.
I know the drill.
I imagine that those people exist, but they would be corner cases, not mainstream use cases, surely.
They are. And those are the people who are also looking at buying switches that have onboard optics. So all you're being presented on the face of the switch are a bunch of either CS connectors, which are those funky fit two into the space of an LC, or MPOs, or some other high density. Don't see that much in data centers.
No, data centers, you got a little more room to stretch out.
And in fact, I would go so far as to say that your basic data center cookie cutter cabinet is going to have 42 1U servers, two 1U high-speed switches, a 48-port 1U out-of-band management switch, and a couple of patch panels.
That's 48U, and that's a standard height rack. Just as an aside, do you put the switches in the middle or at the top?
My personal preference is to put them at the top. I've seen it done all three ways, with top, have all your switching in the middle, and I've seen some people put them all at the bottom.
I've tended to run into problems at the bottom with cooling, because a lot of the hot air, you end up, the switches down the bottom don't get the same access to air down on the floor.
It depends on whether it's a raised floor or not.
Yes.
So if you're in a raised floor environment where you've got your perfed panel right in front of the cabinet, and it just blows right in, so the switches are getting the bulk of the cooling there.
Is the switch generating the most heat, though, and therefore downstream it's just going to be heating up your servers pretty bad?
I don't think so, especially with generic, say, 4825s by 600, your basic Tomahawk switch. They don't generate a whole lot of heat. They suck like 300 watts the last time I measured one.
I had a problem once where they put the switch at the bottom of the rack, but at the back behind the switch, all the cables were coming out of the floor, and all of the cold air wasn't coming out of the floor because the whole vent was actually shut, sealed shut, and they couldn't. And because they were so close to the floor, they weren't able to suck in cold air. It was just, there was some local effect. Yeah.
It's all situational, especially when you start looking at some switches. I can think of a well-known high-density switch vendor based out of the San Francisco Bay Area. Oh, well, that's several of them.
It's all of them, isn't it?
You know what I write down. Well, being ecumenical, but a QFX 16 slot sucks down 20 kilowatts at full throttle.
Yeah, some of them do get quite hot, that's for sure.
And the big Cisco, the Nexus 9000, isn't far behind. They're at like 16.
Yeah. When you're all loaded up, they draw an awful lot of watts, generate a lot of heat, and can be a consideration, I guess.
You mentioned your preference for optical in the rack, Alex, and one of the reasons that I've heard for that is the fact that it's the copper cables are so large that they block too much of the air trying to get into the faceplates of stuff in the rack. So the optical helps you out that way.
Especially if you're using MPOs with sheathing that goes maybe a meter off of the MPO itself so that you can bundle those easily, Velcro only. and then they break out across with measured lengths, and then you have very clean cabling.
Maybe just briefly describe MPOs.
Multi-plug optics. That's your basic 12, I believe it is, positions, and a 4x breakout. We normally use 8 of them.
So there's 24 or 12 fiber optic cores in a single plug at one end, and at the other end you'll have it fan out with X number of pairs for your LCs and all so forth. Very popular way of doing high density fiber optic without having to have dozens and dozens of connectors. It saves a lot of space in the and reliability.
It saves a lot of space. Your reliability, if you have a good fiber vendor who does a lot of testing, is nominal. And that's where, Rob, to your point, you can get the higher densities.
Right.
If you're looking at 160 gig in a 2U switch, 160-100 gig ports in a 2U switch, that's the way you do it.
I also want to say for those MPO cables can be really helpful if you're not breaking them out and you're just using them as a single cable. So say at 40 gig, you had 4 fibers of multimode or transmit, 4 fibers of multimode receive, or single mode. Those cables, although a little bit more expensive, of course, than just duplex fiber where you have one transmit, one receive, the optics at each end can be a lot cheaper, and not a lot of people kind of know that. So it's, if you are doing some greenfield, putting in some new cables, definitely you want to think about MPO parallel fiber cables, because especially at 100 gig and 400 gig, the difference in the price of the optics in each end can be tremendous versus the single fiber optics. And so it's something to think about. And you can go a lot farther on them.
Well, 100 gig SR4 is a 500 meter connection.
Mm-hmm. So. As opposed to if you want to go 500 meters with duplex single mode, the optic at each end are probably going to be 10 times as expensive as the SR4 optics.
Okay.
I'd say twice. Market has changed dramatically.
Okay.
It has come down. Yeah, true.
And CDWM4 is probably your cheapest two-strand solution. There you're looking at reasonable name brand, $400 a piece, $600 for an LR4 of the same brand.
Right.
True, but you can get PSM4 for much cheaper than that, sometimes even cheaper than the SR4s, and you're future-proofed for 400 gig.
Yes, or you could go PAM4 if you really want to play those games.
Fair enough. Yeah, yeah.
but let's not. PAM4 is for pros.
So just for those people who are listening, all of those terms that we use there are the different types of Ethernet encoding, and it describes the way that the optical signal traverses over the fiber. So I'm not going to try and recite all of those numbers because they've sort of passed out of my head in the discussion. But, there are a number of different signal types and each one has a different cabling type. And I guess what we're really talking about here, it would be worth talking to Interoptic if you're working with them and saying, what sort of cabling should I be using? And if I bought this type of optic, was there a difference? And you should be aware of the fact that some types of 25 gig or 100 gig might use 8 fiber cores, some might use 4 fiber cores, and some might use 2, depending on the signaling type that's going across it. And your calculation as to what is the most cost effective for you will vary according to your specific physical needs. Is that a fair assumption, fair statement?
Very.
That's definitely, yeah. We field a lot of questions from customers who, at 10 gig it was, and 1 gig it was pretty simple. You had multi-mode fiber, short reach, and you had single mode fiber, long reach.
Everything else.
And now there's this explosion of form factors and, coding formats and types of fiber and connectors at the end of the fiber. So, we're happy to help. Even people who just aren't customers who just reach out and have a couple of questions. Talking about this sort of complicated stuff, this is the most interesting part of my job.
I want to loop back on one of the discussions that we had with patch leads before. Now, Alex, you said you have a fairly hefty distrust of patch leads and in-rack cabling because it just gets, well, I call it work hardening. And that's where, as they sit in the rack and get flexed and messed around, sometimes they just age. So if I was somebody who was looking at a data center full of 1 gig and I was upgrading, say, to 10 or 25 gig to my servers, would you suggest ditching all of the patch leads that are in that rack and starting again on the assumption that they're just not reliable?
Well, I would suggest ditching them all. If they are 1 gig Cat5e, you have to go to Cat6a for 10 gig.
Right.
If you have a RJ45 type switch. Otherwise, if you have a fiber switch, either go to DAC cables, or if you've got a QSF P28 type switch, you have to go for breakout. You may as well go for the 4x1 copper breakouts. Hmm. They are cheap though. And when you start looking at $300 an hour for remote hands, and you start looking at the difference between certifying cables for reuse or just chucking them and pulling another $25 cable out of the baggie, it's a lot better to pull a new cable out of the baggie and put it in. Hopefully all of your cables have been properly tested before they were put into the baggies though.
Do you find that your fiber optic cables degrade over time? I've had issues in a high density data center where the fiber optic cable that had been sitting in the rack for, well, years, and as soon as you started moving it, quite a lot of the patch leads just failed. Is that something you've seen?
It's something that I saw more of in the mid-2000s. And where I actually saw a lot of failures was in the glue used in the connectors.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, probably they just got heated up and cooled down too many times. And
If you think about it, the glass itself is glass. It's not going anywhere. Kevlar has a lifespan probably equal to the death of the sun.
For realistic purposes, that's probably true. Yeah, at least not lifetime of a data center. I've just had all sorts of problems where fiber optic cables are hanging. They're not supported. This is common in smaller companies. And I've seen those cables just stop working when moved because they've just been hanging for so long, they just snap, I think.
Yeah. It's the jackets take a set.
Right.
Which is why the RDCC people have cabling layouts that you're supposed to follow for longevity. The other question is, realistically, how long do you expect a cable to last? 5 years? 10?
I don't think a lot of people have thought about it, to be fair. They just, you know, plug it in, and if it works, and you take a look at it, and you just keep using it until it fails. But there's a point at which, as you say, the cost of your remote hands, the cost of your labor, the cost of an outage, you should just probably take the opportunity to throw the cable away, because it's cheaper to just put new stuff in than it is to try and sort out what still works and potentially carry those problems forward.
It's within a rack, then yes. But I mean, if you have structured cabling up in your trays, and then also cabling going up risers between floors or between buildings and what have you, like, that's pretty expensive to swap out. And so people really don't want to have to swap that out if they can.
I was more thinking of it in terms of, you know, if I'm, as Alex alluded to earlier, if he's tearing down a rack, he just takes all the cables and bins them on the theory that they're probably damaged or worn to some extent and not reliable after, and recertifying them is a problem. But for campus cabling, which isn't being retired, the only chance you've got is to replace it because it's wearing out. But even in the campus, it does have a life cycle. I mean, 10 years of something sitting in a building, it's starting to collapse at that point, isn't it, Alex?
20 is what I would say. But the other thing is, because inter-building links, even intra-campus, are far fewer than intra-rack or inside a data center where you're going from your cabinet to spine and then off to your cores, usually you recertify each of those pairs before you plug into it because there are many fewer of them.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
So if I buy, say, a link from downtown Chicago to out past O'Hare, we're a Chicago-based company, I expect I'm going to get a spectrum analyzer printout of that cable when it's handed off to me by whoever the vendor is I'm getting it from.
Right.
And then I expect, since those cables do tend to be pretty well installed, I expect to be able to get 20 years out of them. That's what 20-year IRUs were all about.
And just out of curiosity, when you get a report like that, is that just taken at one sort of point in time, or do they give you a report, you know, over the course of like a day or a week or something like that? Like, maybe it's like less common, but I have seen issues show up where if a fiber, you know, say a 40-kilometer fiber is running along a train track or something like that, they only have problems whenever there's like a train running along there.
In my experience as a fiber vendor, we would shoot for 20 minutes on each pair before we handed it off. That's what was budgeted in.
Okay.
Disclaimer, not only did I work for CLEC, I also worked for a dark fiber company.
Dark fiber is a very specific art, and in theory, you would have access to skills or a team of people who could help you with that when it comes to that. I want to go back to the breakout cables, that idea that you just talked about before. Now, Alex, you hinted that you're reluctant to use them because they become a single point of failure, and that's something that you want. Do you also have problems with switches? Because the switches themselves have to have the SerDeses and the gearboxes to do the breakouts. So they have to be able to, you know, if you've got a 100 gig port and you're going to break it out into 4x25s or, you know, whatever it is.
I don't have a problem with that at all because you have to have, in 100 gig at least, you have 4x25 SERDs feeding your 100 gig optic. In 40 gig, it's the same thing. You've got 4x10 SERDs.
Have you found the switches stable and reliable too? So those breakout cables also rely on functions in the switches. Has the code and the hardware been stable?
That's been stable. The two things that I've had interesting issues with is one brand of optic, which I won't mention. It's a name brand though. If you didn't have anything plugged into it, it said to the switch, "Hi, I'm a 40 gig optic." And as soon as you plugged the first pair in and lit up just 110 gig, when the optic recognized the signaling, it would then turn around and say to the switch, "Hi, I'm a 4x10. Let's take me down, drop all the connections, and bring me back up."
Okay. What I hear there is that was in early days. That's not something that's happening now.
No, that was about 3 months ago.
Okay.
Oh, and that points out the problem of, you know, good coding and not so good coding in these cabling and transceivers. You need to be very careful about the coding when you're plugging into switches and routers, because a few bits wrong here and there, the switch won't recognize the device properly, and you can run into all sorts of problems.
So this is something we've covered in previous podcasts, and for people who maybe I'll just recap it, is the SFPs that you plug in to these switches actually got computers and chips, and those chips on the SFP itself actually signal and communicate with the switch, and the code that runs on the SFP itself is critical to the function. It needs to know the switch that it's connected to, and the code that's in the SFP module needs to say I'm a Cisco module or an IMESE module or something like that. And the code is a key part of the value proposition of an SFP module. And in a breakout cable, much more so, I think, is what you're saying, Alex. But Rob, that's what you're saying.
And the solution to this, by the way, is simply to tell the switch, hey, this is a breakout optic. This is also where you get vendor lock-in and vendor optics, which cost 10 to 100 times what you can buy generic optics for on the street.
Just for that code, that signaling.
Just for that code, that signaling. The truth of the matter is all of the major optics vendors know what the coding is and set it properly. But if you try to put a Juniper coded optic into a Cisco, it won't work properly.
Exactly. Yeah, because the Cisco switch is looking for a Cisco module or a module that's been properly coded to, you know, act and behave and look like a Cisco module. And if it gets anything else, you know, you can run into problems. I mean, these switches are looking for, primarily they're looking not just for something that's not a Cisco module, but for something that's a counterfeit module like that. And there's been a lot of talk about that in the last few years. And there's been a lot of problems with counterfeits coming out that, you know, it looks like a branded module and then you plug it in and you find out that it isn't. And so the coding they use is meant to just, you know, suss those out, and because they tend to fail, they tend to have all sorts of problems.
Especially when there are people in the supply chain who are attempting to sell at Cisco prices, but actually subbing in no-name brand or poor quality branded products and stiffing customers. So there's a supply chain integrity issue here that is, you know, I do respect the vendors trying to actually look after customers who, for one way. The flip side of that is, of course, they actually lock out customers from getting commodity components at the same time.
I'd rather buy high quality commodity components from a vendor like, put in your plug here,
Interoptic.
Thank you. I'd rather buy high quality components from a vendor that I can trust, who I know is going to code it properly or code it to the generic MSA standard, than something that looks like a properly branded optic, but
just doesn't have the rest of the code in it, just doesn't work or fails at, you know, doesn't do the things it's supposed to do.
When you need to take a magnifying glass out to look at the printing on the label to see if it's actually clean or if it's got fuzzy edges,
Do you still see a lot of that, Rob, or have the vendors really worked on fixing up the supply chain and preventing counterfeits?
We haven't heard as much about counterfeits lately. I think that now that people are aware of them, they start to look a little bit more carefully for them. But also the counterfeits have gotten sneakier. The labels are better quality. But what hasn't improved is the coding inside of them. Still, you'll buy a bunch of quote-unquote brand name optics, and they all have the same serial number in them or something like that. They haven't been coded properly. Mm-hmm. And you know, the OEMs do their software to look for that sort of thing. And that's something that as a compatible supplier, we are aware of, and we make sure that our devices behave properly when you plug them in.
Well, as we're coming to the end of the show, I think I want to bring the conversation back around to our original premise. How can you retain your legacy data center cabling infrastructure? So if you've got this structured cabling, Rob, and you're thinking about upgrading to 100 gig, what are some of the things that you think customers should be looking at, or what are the planning activities you'd like to suggest to people?
Well, if you built your data center a while ago and you have multi-mode fiber running all throughout it, you don't want to have to pull all that out, which can be expensive proposition. There are things you can do to keep that one going. Maybe you're running 10 gigs through them now and you're thinking, can I run this at 40 gig? Can I run this at 100 gig and beyond? And fortunately, the answer is yes. There are definitely 40 gig solutions that will get you out to say about 300 meters on 50 micron multi-mode fiber. And there's now 100 gig solutions, which will also get you out that far. They're called SWDM and BiDi are the technologies behind those solutions.
They're using higher powered lasers and stuff like that to launch the signal harder and faster.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that they're still relatively low cost too. I mean, SWDM uses cheap VCSEL lasers, four of them, which have been sort of wavelength division multiplexed onto one fiber in a relatively inexpensive way. And that will run nicely over your older multimode fiber for several hundred meters. BiDi uses bidirectional. It uses lasers propagating in both directions on one fiber to, you know, make better use of the bandwidth. Mm. And these can help our customers or anybody's customers extend the life of their data center so that they don't have to suddenly start pulling single mode fiber through their walls and trays.
Totally in agreement. The only thing is, if you're faced with 62.5, bite the bullet and put in mono mode, as we call it back in the United States.
Yeah.
Single mode in UK.
You're like me. I would say to people, if you're thinking about base T, like twisted pair, that's just done. That might work for 10 gigabase T today, but long term, there's no point in installing copper, twisted pair copper between racks. It's all going to be fiber optic. You should be doing at least 50 micron a multi mode, but it really probably wants to be SMF going forward. But if you've got something, there are options available in the SFP pluggable space, and InterOptics got modules, and they can help you select something to make the most of that. Well, quite honestly, I think you should probably burn it all down and start again. But if you can't burn it down and start again, there are answers, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's you definitely want to look into your options in terms of, are you going to pull duplex fibers, so just one fiber in, one fiber out, or these parallel fibers, four fibers in, four fibers out, a little bit more expensive at the get-go, but can definitely save you a lot of money down the road.
Or the other thing is there's always the old IDF-MDF distribution, so you can pull some fairly fat bundles to your end of row and then break out from there.
Exactly. I
like, and this comes back to our discussion around MPOs. I like the modular MPO cabling solutions, and you can often just run them as a sort of a patch lead type idea, high density patch leads. That saves a lot of cost and simplifies the backbone cabling for smaller data centers, not for your size of data center, Alex.
That, or if you're hiring a contractor to do it, they'll come in, they'll put in their like 72 strand cable from wherever to wherever, and then just fusion splice breakouts onto it. Mm-hmm. Because you're not paying the price of a small car for a fusion splicer at that point.
No.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what you can avoid if you get the right optics, which I think is important. And maybe you just don't have the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars to recable. So that's where the right optics can help you out.
Very much.
Exactly.
Well, on that note, I think we should wrap this up. Rob, why don't you tell people where they can find you on the internet?
Yeah. I'm happy to discuss these topics further. You can find me, Robert Conan, on LinkedIn, or reach out to us at Interoptic via our website, interoptic.com.
Yeah. And as you've heard, Robert's in pretty good at good fine form. He actually knows what he's talking about and can help you if you need some advice or some assistance. Get in contact with him. And Alex, thanks so much for coming on the show. Tell us where people can find you on the internet.
People can find me on LinkedIn, Alex Latsko, or you can go to servercentral.com and connect to me through our general info channel.
Well, as always, it's been an absolute privilege to have a sponsor on the show, and particularly with Interoptic, talking about a really practical issue. So thanks very much to them for sponsoring it and to being able to keep us on the air and delivering this type of content. There is this and many more fine free technical podcasts and our community website at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter. You can find us on LinkedIn. Like us on Facebook if you must, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.